You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. I appreciate you tuning in again this week. This is going to be a special episode of Blue Lives Radio. It is called The State of Policing in America. And I'm going to give you my viewpoints on how social change and the current situation in this country is affecting the American law enforcement officer as an individual and the law enforcement community as a whole. So sit back and wait for it. Coming up right now, the state of policing in America. Two entirely different law enforcement incidents involving officers from different departments in different states, but they both illustrate the state of policing in America. The first arises out of an incident in San Antonio, Texas, where police officers were dispatched to a residence because of a disturbance call. When they arrived, they learned that the parents of a 27-year-old man had called them because their son was, quote, throwing things around the house, causing a disturbance, unquote. The unit that responded to this incident was a training unit. There was a sergeant and two probationary officers. Let me explain what that means. The two probationary officers were recently out of the academy, and before they were allowed to go out on their own, they had to be properly trained and evaluated to make sure that they were prepared. What happened next would answer that question. The sergeant and two officers went to the subject's room to deal with the situation, and that's when all hell broke loose. The son was armed with a shotgun and opened fire on the officers. The sergeant returned fire. When the shooting started, the two probationary officers had run away, leaving the sergeant alone to deal with the firefight. You heard me right. They ran away. When I read this report, my jaw dropped. How is it possible that not one, but two officers would turn tail and run? Luckily, the sergeant, a 26-year police veteran, very clearly was a warrior, and he effectively returned fire and killed his attacker. But it could have turned out very differently. In the aftermath, the chief of San Antonio Police Department, William McManus, did exactly what he should have done. He fired the two probationary officers immediately, and in what I can only say was a masterful understatement, he said, quote, "I felt it best that these two officers needed to look for another profession," unquote. Yes, I would have to agree. But now here's the question that looks deeper into this incident. How is it that these two cowards were not weeded out before the shooting even took place? How did they get through the hiring process? How did they make it out of the academy? Had one of these officers revealed themselves to not have what it takes in a critical incident, well, that would not be all that unusual. But two, I believe that this incident may be just another symptom of what is happening across America. That is a shrinking pool of qualified people applying for law enforcement jobs. Recruiting efforts that focus on guardianship personalities instead of warrior mentalities, basic police training that has been tainted by politically correct curriculum instead of officer survival tactics designed to save officers' lives, and second, third, and fourth chances when new officers demonstrate early on they do not have what it takes to be an effective law enforcement officer. Why? Because law enforcement agencies are not only cost conscious, but they are afraid of legal backlash when they hold incompetent or unsafe officers accountable during their training and they don't dismiss them. The reality is that this is not really something new. Law enforcement history is peppered with tragic and embarrassing scandals resulting directly from hiring substandard people because of political considerations or cronyism. Now, let's move a couple of states over to the second incident. Pittsburgh, California police responded to a call in which a man had called them to report that his son, a 33-year-old man, had tried to stab him through a closed screen door. Officers responded and found the suspect about 3 blocks away. Knowing that he was armed, the officers surrounded him and attempted to negotiate with him. This situation was recorded, and if we could all take a look at what transpired, you'd be shocked. The Pittsburgh officers were clearly highly trained. They had good coverage in terms of numbers of officers. They had what appeared to be a strategy and a plan using low lethality tools such as beanbag rounds, a taser, and also a canine. And yet, the suspect managed to stab an officer in the neck. Why? Because these officers chose to go hands-on with a suspect armed with a deadly weapon. This particular arrest had a somewhat happy ending. No critical injuries or death, but in reality, this was only an accident. The officer who was stabbed in his neck could easily have been catastrophically injured or killed. The chief of police, Brian Addington, commended all of the officers for their extreme constraint throughout the encounter with the suspect and said that their actions were heroic. In essence, what we saw was diametrically opposed to the San Antonio incident. In Pittsburgh, we saw officers charge into the danger zone, but here's my concern and my question. Why did these officers make a conscious choice to place themselves in danger of being stabbed when they could have used deadly force legally and tactically? Could it be that they were more concerned with the legal and political environment that is now pervading California and other states that are embracing the concept of purposeful persecution and prosecution in law enforcement deadly force incidents? Could a factor be that the highly publicized shooting of Stephon Clark in Sacramento, which found that the officers acted properly but still incited political leaders like the mayor of Sacramento to call for a change in laws to allow police to be charged criminally, even though the shooting may have been justified? Could that have played a conscious or subconscious role in the Pittsburgh officers' decisions? There's absolutely no doubt the law enforcement officers are facing increasing scrutiny for deadly force incidents, sometimes having to withstand investigations by multiple bodies of government that take months or even years to complete. Knowing that their decisions that they are forced to make in seconds will have lifelong consequences is just one more factor in the unfolding crisis of recruitment and retention of law enforcement officers in America. And that is a part of the state of policing in America. I want to tell you guys about a pretty amazing product. It's called Arrest My Vest Spray. And really what it's designed to do is when you are wearing a ballistic vest, you know, it gets sweaty, it gets hot, it gets drenched, from working out in the street. And sometimes it doesn't smell all that well. And this is an amazing product that takes that odor away. And you don't even have to use it just for the vest. It takes pet odors away. It's great for your vest. It's great for your dog bed, everything else that you need a deodorizer for. This stuff is amazing. Check it out. It's at stinkyvest.com. Go to stinkyvest.com and check out Arrest My Vest Spray and arrest the odors. I want to tell you about a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. If you are an active duty law enforcement officer and you're looking to work extra jobs like security and traffic jobs, these are the people you need to go through. We all know that working extra jobs is what gives us the extras, gives us that little extra payment that we need, or perhaps gives us the opportunity to take our families out to dinner a little more often. And the only way to do it is to be working extra jobs. So what they do is they're all over America. I think they're in everything but a couple of states. And they work with your organization, your administration, and find off-duty jobs to work. got to check them out. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com and register with them, contact them. Now, if you have security needs, this is the company you want to go through as well. If you are looking for both security or traffic jobs, if you have a company that requires that, you want to contact these folks as well. They're good people. They're based in Arizona, but they have police officers and services all over the country. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. This week saw yet one more acquittal of a police officer who was charged criminally after an officer-involved shooting. East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosefeld was charged with first-degree murder, third-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, and involuntary manslaughter after shooting and killing 17-year-old Antoine Rose. Let me say that again. The officer was charged with first-degree, third-degree, voluntary manslaughter, and involuntary manslaughter, all for the same incident. The jury debated a whole 4 hours before finding the now former officer innocent of all charges. Now let's talk about the facts that we know. Officer Rosefeld, who just happened to have been on his first day on the job as an East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania police officer, heard a radio broadcast about a drive-by shooting in an adjacent community. Several suspects in a gold Chevy Cruze had opened fire on a man walking down the street and struck him in the abdomen. But the victim had apparently shot back and shattered the rear window of the car. Just minutes later, Officer Rosefeld spotted the car riddled with bullets and pulled it over. Antoine Rose, who was a passenger, failed to comply with the officer's orders and fled on foot, with the officer chasing him. According to testimony, Rosefeld thought he saw a gun and opened fire on Rose, killing him. It turned out that the suspect was not armed, but did have a pistol magazine on him and gunshot residue on his hands, and the stolen gun was found in the car. Another suspect in the car was convicted of the shooting. The officer was white and the suspect was black. Protests began immediately, and as a result, the entire small department of East Pittsburgh Police was disbanded after it was accused of racism. In fact, the city council was accused by the protesters of being part of the KKK during these protests. The Allegheny County District Attorney took on the case, and after making incendiary remarks about the officer's actions, piled on the charges, even though in his own statement to the media, the district attorney said that he knew that first-degree murder was not the appropriate charge. The reality is that the law is pretty clear when it comes to fleeing felons. If the officer can articulate why he or she believed that the fleeing felon posed a danger to themselves or others, they are legally justified in using deadly force. The fact that Rose was a suspect in an attempted murder with a gun would easily give rise to that articulation of a deadly threat. They do not have to have a gun pointed at them in order to use deadly force. Now, the district attorney knew this, but chose to charge this officer with murder anyway. Even though he was ultimately found innocent, this young man's life is ruined. And just hours after the acquittal, the attorney who represented the former officer had his law office shot up. This level of hate has now become part of the political landscape. As protesters take over the streets and force entire police agencies to shutter their doors, we have players like this district attorney who are only too willing to throw the sacrificial lamb into the waiting jaws of political and, quote, social justice, unquote, predators for their own political agendas. Now, this is happening all over America. We saw it demonstrated in all its political pageantry in the Baltimore debacle after the death of Freddie Gray, when state's attorney Marilyn Mosby prostituted her office by charging 6 Baltimore police officers in Gray's death. As she pontificated to the crowd that, quote, our time is now, unquote. Great sound bites and total vote pandering. But alas, her prosecutorial misconduct and ineptitude succeeded only to grab headlines and reveal herself as the incompetent, agenda-driven politician she truly is. And after millions of dollars wasted, lives ruined, and justice trampled upon, all of the officers that she falsely accused were exonerated or had the charges dropped. But a new breed of prosecutor was born, and many more have followed suit. Activist prosecutors have sprung up in cities across America, funded by millions of dollars supplied by George Soros-backed organizations. These anti-law enforcement lawyers proudly not only ignore the laws they have sworn to uphold as they release more and more criminals into the very communities that elected them, but are also waging war against the police officers in those communities. They do this by way of wholesale dismissal of legitimate charges, often in the name of social justice, failure to prosecute assaults against law enforcement officers, and when the opportunity arises, charging officers with murder whenever the opportunity does arise despite the legitimacy of the shootings. We've seen it in St. Louis with the prosecution of Officer Jason Stockley, in Tulsa with the prosecution of Officer Betty Shelby, in Minnesota with the prosecution of Jeremonio Yanez, and in North Carolina with the prosecution of Deputy Joshua Happy Hopkins. And in all of these cases, just like Officer Roosevelt, all were found innocent. But let's be very clear here. Simply because eventually all of these officers were cleared, the devastating effect of being charged with murder or manslaughter is catastrophic emotionally, psychologically, and financially. The fact that prosecutors and district attorneys have suddenly veered away from their role as the chief law enforcement officer in the counties where they were elected to instead to become agenda-driven social justice warriors is not only disturbing, it's dangerous. Dangerous to the communities that they were elected to serve, dangerous to the criminal justice system itself, and dangerous to the men and women who each and every day put on their badge and risk their lives. And that is part of the state of policing in America. The stench of corruption emanating from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office in Illinois has been circulating for the entire tenure of State's Attorney Kim Fox. But it took the high-profile investigation of Jussie Smollett to bring to light the rampant misconduct of this activist prosecutor. The public outcry from this outrageous display of politically influenced decision-making on the part of Fox may just be a watershed moment in what is fast becoming a nationwide movement of social activism on the part of prosecuting attorneys. What I find particularly interesting and at the same time disturbing is the absolute arrogance on display on the part of State's Attorney Fox. Let's step back in time for just a moment and think about the initial report that Jussie Smollett filed with the Chicago Police Department. His initial story concerning what he described as a racist, homophobic attack on himself was at the outset a tale which stretched the limits of credibility. The public reaction to the initial report were not only sympathetic to the actor, but also pushed a political narrative of widespread racism that further divided this country. But as the Chicago police investigation began to reveal inconsistencies in his story, eventually leading up to the dramatic announcement from Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson that the entire incident had been a carefully orchestrated fiction designed to bring attention and sympathy to Smollett, we began to see public anger turn towards Smollett. In my 30-year police career, I have rarely seen a law enforcement leader publicly decry a public figure such as Jussie Smollett as I did in this case. And there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that had Superintendent Johnson not had ironclad evidence of the guilt of Jussie Smollett, the now infamous press conference never would have taken place. The subsequent grand jury indictment of Smollett on 16 felony counts was not only appropriate, but necessary to show the nation that such an abomination and misuse of the criminal justice system would not be tolerated despite the fame and notoriety of the individual involved. And in fact, there was a collective sigh of relief with the knowledge that the criminal justice system was working appropriately and that Smollett would face the appropriate punishment for his actions. But then it happened. Without notifying the Chicago Police Department, State's Attorney Kimberly Fox shocked not only the Chicago PD, but the entire nation when her office announced that the charges would be dropped in return for 2 days of community service and Smollett forfeiting his $10,000 bond. The office further announced that the judge had already sealed the record and had the charges expunged. The shock and frustration felt by Chicago Police Superintendent Johnson was evident in the angry and emotional response by not only him, but by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Information soon began to surface regarding Fox having been in contact with Michelle Obama's chief of staff in regards to their support for Smollett. In fact, the influence of Smollett's family through the politically connected Obamas had already seen Fox's interference in the investigation by her request on behalf of the family to Superintendent Johnson to have the entire investigation turned over to the FBI instead of the Chicago police. At that point, she had allegedly recused herself. However, her underlings in the state's attorney's office clearly were doing her bidding. What she was unprepared for was the incredible blowback, not just from the police, but from all areas of the political spectrum, as well as intense scrutiny from the media. The almost universal criticism of the decision and accusations of political interference and favoritism forced Fox into damage control mode. But even her attempts to paint the situation as, quote, normal, unquote, did nothing except cause her even more outcry. Her ineptitude in trying to even cover up what was clearly misconduct on her part revealed itself in her confusing public statements and the revelation that she had ordered her staff to search through prior cases so she could justify such a decision. Kimberly Fox clearly miscalculated how her blatant disregard for the law and willingness to participate in what is essentially a cover-up of criminal behavior would shock the American public. What many people do not know is that Fox has been at war with the Chicago Police Department since her election. The Chicago Police Union, the Fraternal Order of Police, have been calling for a federal investigation into the state's attorney's office for 2 years. But since she has, in essence, been allowed to bring her brand of social justice into the Chicago criminal justice system, she has felt empowered to continue, which perhaps explains the current situation in which she finds herself. I mentioned earlier that perhaps this was a watershed moment in the trend of political activist prosecutors and district attorneys. I say this hopefully because across the nation this trend has been allowed to continue without getting the scrutiny it has deserved. Perhaps as we see the situation in Chicago develop, we might see Kimberly Fox facing consequences for her actions up to and including a federal investigation into her conduct and decision making, not only in the Smollett case, but into her entire tenure as the Cook County State's Attorney. Perhaps this will serve as a warning to other prosecutors and district attorneys who have consciously made decisions to allow their political activisms to rule their judgments instead of their sworn duty to uphold the laws and protect the people that elected them. Only time will tell. And that is part of the state of policing in America. I want to tell you guys about a pretty amazing product. It's called Arrest My Vest Spray. And really what it's designed to do is when you are wearing a ballistic vest, you know, it gets sweaty, it gets hot, it gets drenched, from working out in the street. and sometimes it doesn't smell all that well. And this is an amazing product that takes that odor away. And you don't even have to use it just for the vest. It takes pet odors away. It's great for your vest. It's great for your dog bed. Everything else that you need a deodorizer for, this stuff is amazing. Check it out. It's at stinkyvest.com. Go to stinkyvest.com and check out Arrest My Vest Spray and arrest the odors. I want to tell you about a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. If you are an active duty law enforcement officer and you're looking to work extra jobs like security and traffic jobs, these are the people you need to go through. We all know that working extra jobs is what gives us the extras, gives us that little extra payment that we need, or perhaps gives us the opportunity to take our families out to dinner a little more often. And the only way to do it is to be working extra jobs. So what they do is they're all over America. I think they're in everything but a couple of states. And they work with your organization, your administration, and find off-duty jobs to work. You got to check them out. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com and register with them, contact them. Now, if you have security needs, this is the company you want to go through as well. If you are looking for both security or traffic jobs, if you have a company that requires that, you want to contact these folks as well. They're good people. They're based in Arizona, but they have police officers and services all over the country. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutloud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
When did the police become America's punching bags? And I mean that literally as well as figuratively. Was there a defining moment, or did our country gradually morph into a society where the authority of law enforcement officers has eroded to the point where even grade school children no longer fear consequences from confrontations with the police? Now, I know that simply using the word fear in a conversation about law enforcement is in and of itself politically incorrect. I mean, after all, if one was to listen to all of the political rhetoric coming from senators, congressmen, governors, mayors, and all assorted others who consider themselves experts in law enforcement and community relationships, the police should work tirelessly and relentlessly to reform themselves into a kinder and gentler culture. Every discussion concerning violence and law enforcement always and inevitably will center around fault. Whose fault? I'll give you just one guess. Of course, the fault of the police. Let's take a short walk down memory lane. Remember just a few years ago when everyone, from the media to the President of the United States, Barack Obama, were crying out for body-worn cameras to be issued to every police officer in the United States. Why? to protect the public from those mean old bullies, the police. The word reform was the rallying cry for politicians and the media and the social justice warriors. So, quite literally, millions and millions of dollars have been spent on equipping law enforcement officers across the United States with body-worn cameras. But I wonder if you've noticed this. When was the last time that you heard these demands for body-worn cameras? The answer is you probably haven't. Why? The answer is also quite simple. The reality is that the use of body-worn cameras has revealed that law enforcement officers are acting appropriately, not using force unnecessarily, and have shown that it is actually the police who need to be protected from the public. And once again, and I mean this both physically, in terms of assault against them, and in the thousands of frivolous and concocted complaints filed against them for everything from excessive force to sexual assault. Yes, the evidence is quite clear. The vast majority of law enforcement officers in this country do their jobs as they are expected to do. And yet the war against cops continues, not only unabated, but is accelerating. Every single day, a law enforcement officer puts on his uniform or her uniform and goes out on patrol, they are quite literally putting their lives on the line. The murder rate against officers continues. Shootings of officers takes place almost daily in this country, and physical assaults have become commonplace. The important question here is why? I'm going to relate my theory, and I'm going to relate my solution. I'm pretty sure that the International Chiefs of Association of Chiefs of Police will not be adopting it. As to my theory of why, because all of the reforms that law enforcement has been called upon to make have been all too successful. All of the mandatory training and de-escalation techniques, sensitivity training, and community relations combined with law enforcement administration's heavy-handed disciplinary processes relating to use of force incidents have sufficiently intimidated working cops into becoming minimally aggressive in order to survive the political environment. Some refer to this as depolicing, and that is an accurate characterization. It is simply a matter of survival, not only physical survival, but political survival. And what does this look like? It means less proactive police work. It means fewer car stops looking for criminals. It means fewer pedestrian stops looking for guns, drugs, and fugitives. It means fewer physical encounters. It means getting out of the patrol car less. It means taking fewer risks, as in you'll never get in trouble for the car stop you don't make. In other words, it means the bad guys are winning. When the police are afraid to do their job, not because of the physical dangers, but because of the political dangers, society as a whole becomes a much more hazardous place to be. I told you before that I also had a solution. Everything that I just talked about concerning the factors of depolicing empowers criminality. It empowers civil unrest and violence and injustice. Why? Because when people figure out there are no consequences for their actions, the reality is that the ugliness of human nature is unleashed. Robbers find it easier to rob. Thieves find it easier to steal. Drug dealers deal their poison with impunity, and our very society becomes threatened. I believe it is time to bring back the fear. Fear of consequences, first and foremost. And that includes the fear of the police. Now, does that sound harsh? Well, I believe a little fear is healthy. I think that fear is a deterrent to criminality. I think that someone should be fearful of putting their hands on a law enforcement officer. I think that someone should be fearful of pulling a gun on a police officer. I think that someone should be fearful of becoming argumentative and disrespectful to a police officer and resisting arrest. I served as a cop for 34 years, and I'll tell you this, as sure as hell I'm sitting here, I lived by this rule. If you try to hurt me, I'm going to hurt you back. If you try to kill me, I'm going to kill you first. Simple. Those are the rules of the road. It's time for police leadership to stop surrendering to political whims and fantasies. Law enforcement is often messy. Law enforcement is often ugly. And law enforcement is always dangerous. It is the responsibility of political leaders, and it is the responsibility of law enforcement leaders, to make the playing field as safe as possible for the men and women who serve in our nation's law enforcement agencies. That means understanding that law enforcement officers will need to use force, including deadly force, to accomplish their mission and safeguard their own lives. And no amount of political correctness should stand in the way of allowing our nation's law enforcement officers to do what they are paid to do: serve and protect. And that includes protecting themselves. I would like to give you the dictionary definition of a word. The word is privilege. It's defined as a special right, advantage, or immunity granted or available only to a particular person or group. Now, we have all heard about wealth privilege, white privilege, and social class privilege. It seems that we are very good in this country creating groups that claim or are accused of privilege. In fact, I believe that there has been an entirely new privileged class created in the last few years by political leaders, from a president to local mayors, political elitists, social justice advocates, media outlets, and even in some cases, law enforcement leadership and district attorneys. It is not a class of people that in my entire police career I would ever have thought would come to power. But alas, I was wrong. I have dubbed this new privileged class the criminally privileged, also known as the criminally entitled. When I first joined the law enforcement community as a police officer, it was admittedly a few decades ago, but not exactly the distant past. Yet the changes that have taken place, both during my tenure as a police officer and in the years following, have taken a dramatic turn for the worse in terms of our criminal justice system. It seems that our criminal justice system should be, how shall I put this, rebranded and renamed the criminal injustice system. Now, I am in no way, shape, or form trying to tell you that back in the good old days, the criminal justice system ever performed up to the standards we expected. It's always been imperfect. There's always been injustice. Yet the system itself, as imperfect as it was, always held a promise. A promise that said, I know I don't always get it right, but I'm trying like hell. Well, that promise now seems as archaic and outdated as the promises I uttered to my first girlfriend in the throes of adolescent passion, and just as desperate and clumsy. Let's go back to the basic premise of what laws and the justice system was created for: to control behavior, to codify society's right to protect people from criminal behavior. In a perfect world, of course, there'd be no need for criminal laws. People wouldn't kill each other. People wouldn't rape or pillage. And everyone would go about their daily business without fear and in safety. But of course, we know that human nature, being what it is often cruel and ugly and greedy and self-serving. For that reason, systems of justice are put into place to create a social contract that governs people's conduct for the greater good of society as a whole. For years, our criminal justice system has been based on the approach that if you commit a crime, you'll be punished for committing the crime. I mean, it's a fairly simple system when you think about it. It's about consequences for actions. Don't do the crime, and you won't have to do the time. But what happens when there are no consequences for committing crimes? Ridiculous, you were probably saying to yourself. There are always consequences for getting caught when you commit a crime. Not when you're the criminally privileged or the criminally entitled. You see, when you're in the criminally privileged class, there are no consequences for committing criminal offenses. Absurd, you say? I would have said this premise was absurd up to a few years ago. But that was before I heard a sitting president of the United States say that a police officer acted stupidly for simply investigating a reported crime. And that was before the same president pardoned a soldier who committed treason against his country and released thousands of criminals from federal prison in the name of social justice. But that was just the beginning of the birth of the criminally privileged. The year 2014 saw the state of California truly give birth to the criminally privileged movement. It was called Proposition 47 and was sold to the public who voted for it as a cost-saving measure. It's interesting to note recently that the politician in California that put forth Proposition 47 was awarded the Golden Fleece Award given to politicians in the United States for squandering public money and lying to the public. You see, what Proposition 47 was really about was decriminalizing a number of crimes and downgrading others to the point of no punishment. You see, Proposition 47 downgraded a variety of, quote, non-serious, non-violent crimes, unquote, that had previously been considered felonies. These included shoplifting, grand theft, receiving stolen property, forgery, fraud, writing bad checks, as long as the total value of stolen property is under $950 a day, only a ghost of an offense has occurred. A thief may now steal something under that limit on a daily basis, and it will never rise to felony status. You might be scratching your head and saying, well, if there's no punishment for stealing, wouldn't that make crime go up? And of course, the answer is yes, except that if you no longer consider it a crime statistically, crime can't go up now, can it? But of course, a monkey in silk is still a monkey. And the reality is that the victimization of the very same people who voted for Proposition 47 has astronomically risen. But with the police being powerless to do anything about those preying on others and stealing them blind, people have simply stopped calling the police and making the reports, thus making the statistics appear to show a reduction in criminal activities, which of course is the ultimate irony. But Proposition 47 is not the only example of how the criminally privileged class has come to be. Millions of dollars has been poured into the political campaigns of social activist lawyers who run for office as district attorneys and prosecutors. Once elected, in the truest sense of the Trojan horse, they infiltrate these offices, charged with prosecuting crimes, and then reveal their social and political agendas as they inflicted their own forms of Proposition 47 by declining to prosecute absolute litanies of offenses. For instance, in Boston, District Attorney Rollins has refused to prosecute for trespassing, shoplifting, larceny, disorderly conduct, disturbing the peace, receiving stolen property, breaking and entering, wanton or malicious destruction of property, threats, minor in possession of alcohol, drug possession with intent to distribute, and resisting arrest. In Dallas, Texas, statewide police union has called for the removal of Dallas County District Attorney John Cruzo, who has announced plans not to prosecute certain crimes, including theft under $750. In Philadelphia, District Attorney Larry Krasner has initiated similar policies and, in fact, has reduced murder charges in a number of cases to lower-level offenses in the name of social justice. What is the effect of the creation of the criminally privileged class? The consequences are staggering. The property loss is incalculable, quite literally, because statistics are no longer being kept. Stores are going out of business as they can no longer combat the loss and are powerless to do anything about the theft. Quality of life is diminishing from city to city as homeless encampments become open-air toilets and take over entire neighborhoods. Citizens are losing confidence in their police because they are powerless to combat these issues when enforcement tools such as arrest and jail are no longer an option. And speaking of the police, their morale is in the toilet because they no longer are allowed to be effective and actually fight crime. And if they actually do, they're often vilified by political leadership and the media, thus creating the perfect environment for depolicing, which in all reality is exactly what the social activist movement is all about to begin with, to fundamentally dismantle the criminal justice system in the United States of America. I know that I'm painting a rather bleak picture, but the reality is that more and more cities are falling prey to the siren song of criminal justice reform, which is, for all intents and purposes, a wolf dressed in sheep's clothing. You see, the term criminal justice reform is so nebulous, it can mean anything. It's really a part of the buzzword bingo of political correctness and was invented to absolve criminals from accountability for their own actions. The harsh reality is this: a society that refuses to protect itself by demanding accountability on the part of its citizens for committing crimes is a society doomed to failure. And that is the state of policing in America. I'm going to ask you to go to thewoundedblue.org. That's www.thewoundedblue.org. That is the website for the organization that is the National Association for Injured and Disabled Police Officers. It is a support organization for these men and women who have given so much in the line of duty. We desperately need your help to raise money to get this movement going. And if you are a GoFundMe-er, go to GoFundMe, look up The Wounded Blue, and you can give there as well. But check it out, please, and also check out our film, The Wounded Blue, on Amazon.com.
I'd like you to meet Susan Price, Gold Star mother and weekly columnist on America Out Loud. Susan, as a Gold Star mom, what does patriotism mean to you?
Taking part in America at a larger scale of all the issues taking place today. Our blood is red, white, and blue. Patriotism to me means taking a stand and letting your voice be heard.
Speaking of which, there's an old saying that you either get involved in politics or politics will get involved with you. So when we say, let the silent voices be heard, how do we turn the tide of ignorance in the world today?
Wow, and how profound is that? We get out there, we let our voices be heard, we educate our children.
As a weekly columnist on America Out Loud, Susan, you're sort of like an investigative reporter. Or sometimes we call that in the business, like a dog with a bone. So what is your ultimate goal with your weekly column on America Out Loud?
The one goal that I have in mind is to raise the consciousness of the subject at hand, especially those who are clueless and have no idea that there is a problem in the first place. That's making a difference.
Our goal is simple: to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. It's to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. America Out Loud. Welcome to the new era in communications.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we have a duty, and that is to honor the men and women of the law enforcement profession who have made the ultimate sacrifice and given their lives in the line of duty. I have a number of officers who made that ultimate sacrifice to read today. The first is Police Officer William J. Leahy of the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey Police Department. Police Officer William Leahy died as a result of the cancer that he developed following his assignment to the search and recovery efforts at the World Trade Center site following the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Officer Leahy has served with the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey Police Department for 27 years, was assigned to John F. Kennedy International Airport. He is survived by his parents. Police Officer William J. Leahy, Port Authority of New York, New Jersey Police Department, End of Watch, Thursday, June 6th, 2019. Second is Police Officer Esmeralda Ramirez of the Los Angeles Police Department in California. Police Officer Esmeralda Ramirez succumbed to injuries sustained in a vehicle crash in 2015. She passed away after experiencing complications as a result of required surgery related to her injuries. Officer Ramirez has served with the police department for 11 years and was assigned to the Pacific Division. She is survived by her three adult children. Police Officer Esmeralda Ramirez, Los Angeles Police Department, California, End of Watch, Sunday, June 9th, 2019. Third is Sergeant David Jones Fitzpatrick of the Colony Police Department in Texas. Sergeant David Fitzpatrick suffered a fatal heart attack after participating in the department's wellness program on June 7th. He collapsed after returning to his office after working out. He was transported to a local hospital where he passed away on June 10th without having regained consciousness. Sergeant Fitzpatrick was a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, has served with the Colony Police Department for over 34 years. He is survived by his wife. Sergeant David Jones Fitzpatrick, the Colony Police Department, Texas. End of watch, Monday, June 10th, 2019. The next is Deputy Sheriff Julius Jamal J. Daly of the Monroe County Sheriff's Office in Alabama. Deputy Sheriff J. Daly was killed in a vehicle crash while responding to a burglary in progress at 11:58 p.m. His patrol car left the roadway on a curve in the 1100 block of Highway 41 and overturned, causing him to suffer fatal injuries. He was extricated from the vehicle and transported to a local hospital where he passed away. Deputy Daly had served with the Monroe County Sheriff's Office for only 4 months. He had previously served with the Alabama Department of Corrections and the Thomasville Police Department. He is survived by his daughter. Deputy Sheriff J. Daly, Monroe County Sheriff's Office, Alabama. End of watch, Tuesday, June 11th, 2019. The next is Police Officer Stephen Brown of the Port St. Lucie Police Department in Florida. Police Officer Stephen Brown suffered a fatal heart attack after completing a third day of leading the Port St. Lucie Police Athletic League's police camp. He was one of the camp leaders as part of his summertime duties as a school resource officer. The camp involved 3 days of strenuous outdoor activities, including an obstacle course at the Navy SEAL Museum. Officer Brown collapsed after returning home at the end of his shift, June 12th. Officer Brown served with the Port St. Lucie Police Department for 14 years. He is survived by his wife, son, and daughter. Police Officer Stephen J. Brown, Port St. Lucie Police Department, Florida. End of watch, Wednesday, June 12th, 2019. The next is Trooper William Moden of the Colorado State Patrol, Colorado. Trooper William Moden was struck and killed by a vehicle while assisting at the scene of an earlier crash on I-70 in Deer Trail, Colorado. He was checking on the occupants of one of the involved vehicles when another car struck him at approximately 9:40 p.m. Another trooper on the scene immediately began providing medical care. Trooper Moden was flown to the University of Colorado Hospital, where he succumbed to his injuries the following morning. Trooper Moden had served with the Colorado State Patrol for 12 years. Trooper William Moden, Colorado State Patrol, Colorado. End of watch, Saturday, June 15th, 2019. And the next is Patrol Officer John D. Hetland of the Racine Police Department in Wisconsin. Patrol Officer John Hetland was shot and killed while intervening in an armed robbery while off duty at 9:40 p.m. He observed the robbery occurring outside of a bar at 1936 Lathrop Avenue and took immediate action to intervene. The subject opened fire on him, fatally wounding him. The subject fled the scene and remains at large. Officer Hetland had served with the Racine Police for 24 years. He is survived by his two children and parents. Patrol Officer John D. Hetland, Racine Police Department, Wisconsin. End of watch, Monday, June 17th, 2019. Each of these officers made the ultimate sacrifice, gave their lives in the line of duty. May they rest in peace. I want to thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. We try to bring you the truth about the American law enforcement officer and the stories that are written and reported about them. I also would love for you to come onto Facebook and look me up under the Voice of American Law Enforcement, like me, follow me. And if you haven't, please check out the website that goes along with our organization, The Wounded Blue. It's thewoundedblue.org. This is a charitable organization that assists injured and disabled law enforcement officers. And if you haven't seen our film, go to either iTunes or Amazon or the Microsoft Store and look up The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. Thanks again for tuning in. We will see you next week right here on The Voice of American Law Enforcement.